How can investors strategically add value to multifamily properties?
The way I look at it is invasive and non-invasive. An invasive one would be like a rehab. And the non-invasive way of doing a value add is basically if you can identify below rent market values that you can increase, like I've done plays that I could have increased 20%.
What are some of the key elements that you consider when you're evaluating whether a multifamily property is going to be a good investment?
I got basically three main things to say.
Welcome to Nursing Real Wealth. Today, we are thrilled to have Doran Levi, an accomplished investor with a diverse background. Doran is an ex-first lieutenant, Air Force serviceman in the Israeli Defense Force, a multifamily developer, builder, and resort owner, and a private equity investor and lender. He has built and sold multiple multi-million dollar companies and currently owns several businesses. Doran, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Justin. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Looking forward to getting into your story here. And I've noticed I've got a lot of folks lined up for this season. And, you know, one of the things that I think is kind of cool is as I reflected on who I've got lined up, many of them are immigrants to the United States. And so it's going to be very interesting as we kind of like share the majority of season three is going to end up being a lot of immigrants stories of success within our community. So that topic's near and dear to my heart because my wife actually just got her approval, just passed her citizenship interview. So she's going to be taking her oath. She's been a permanent resident, legal permanent resident in the United States for 8 years now.
That's amazing. I saw it on Facebook.
Yeah.
Congratulations, man. What a life-changing moment.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's exciting. So Doran, let's start from the very beginning with you. If you would share a bit about your childhood and upbringing in Israel, including your time serving in the IDF.
Okay. So if we start with my childhood, well, I didn't have it easy. That's for sure. I basically am one of two twins. I have a twin brother. And I was born in Israel, but I was actually raised in Kenya. I was brought to Kenya at about 3 years of age. And we basically lived there for a couple of years before my brother got sick. He was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And so we kind of swung it for about, 6 months or whatever. We had to come back because the doctors said that they have to fly to where, hospitals are better health system, for lack of better, descriptions. And we flew back to Israel and, pretty much ever since I kind of raised myself because I was always by the shadow of a sick brother. So I wasn't really, in hindsight, getting the, now I'm a parent of three, and now I see that wasn't really getting like a whole bunch of attention that the, kids that age need. And so I pretty much became on my own since I'm 14. I didn't have the great environment growing up, and I just went into a military academy and Air Force Military Academy, and it was kind of a pivoting moment for me to realize that, the only one's going to do me is me. So I kind of, my dad was great at the end of the day. He was just providing. He was never around. My mom was always in the hospital with my brother. So, fast forward, finished military academy, went into the Air Force, did my thing there. Basically, worked a lot with F-15s, F-16s, nights of days and days of night, night flights and just a whole bunch of, really, really interesting stuff. I can't really get into it, but, when you're surrounded all your four borders by enemy lines, you can only imagine we had a lot of action all the time and a lot of thinking on your feet, a lot of outside of the box thinking, or, there's a lot of lives being lost. And And we certainly encountered a few. One of my best friends died with my service belt that I gave him last minute when he got, you know, called on an emergency flight. So, you know, I left service basically feeling that I always wanted to do more than what kind of I felt I can do in Israel. You know, I felt that I can always do more and be more. And I just felt kind of like I have a glass ceiling. It took me a whole long of a time to realize that. And I just went on a plane and came here by myself pretty much. That's how I got here. That was 99, so about 24, almost 25 years ago, right?
Yeah, wow, wow. You know, how was that experience of immigrating to the United States? I mean, you're all alone, you're just like showing up in the country, and yeah, tell me about that. Like, what was that like, that process?
Well, I want to, the first answer in mind is challenging, but I think it's an understatement to say that. You know, I'm in a foreign country with not a whole lot of English. You know, I kind of had to, I mean, I was lucky enough to be in a British school as a child in Kenya. You know, I was raised in Mombasa, then Nairobi. So I had some exposure to the English language, and as a child, I soaked some of it, but it was nothing fluent, right? And it's a lot of figuring out. It's a lot of, you know, thinking along the lines of survival. You know, you're not really having any kind of comfort of a safety net of either parents or friends or you know, any kind of family member, really, if you think about it. And it's kind of do or die 24/7 for quite a few years, to be honest with you. You know, you're an immigrant. There's a lot of restrictions. You can't do a lot of stuff that normal citizens do. You know, you can't buy a car. You can't have a driving license. Things that people take for granted, you can't really do. So it was a very constricting space to work within and try to actually, you know, propel your life forward.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's amazing. Obviously, you know, we're here in the United States now, and you've done some amazing things. Before we get into the depth of that, I did want to, you know, just quickly glance on the fairly obvious topic. Your country, your homeland, is under attack right now, and or has been under attack and many times, and is now in a conflict with a dreadful enemy, and we see very unprecedented behavior. I see unprecedented behavior. You know, you look back to 1940s and you see these almost surreal moments of people hating a whole group of people, intense racism, intense hatred. And you think to yourself, oh, that could never happen again, because we see so clearly that was so heinous and evil. And yet I see people in my own country, in my own state, for crying out loud, who are speaking with such rhetoric and hatred for your people. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to speak to that and just share your thoughts on this.
Wow, that's a really charged topic. I don't know that we have enough time to really get into the depth of it. But on a very high level, you know, I feel that a lot of it is propaganda, and you know, a lot could be said about who's fueling that propaganda and why are they doing it, right? But you know, like me and you said before, the truth is the truth, and there is no truth behind the accusations. There are written history lessons and just evidence of stuff to support it. It's just propaganda. And regardless of who's right or wrong, October 7th basically was two things. One was a lot of lines that nobody should ever cross. You know, when you burn babies in their cribs, and when you kill a mother in front of their her child, and then the parent, and you know, there's things that you don't do, and you know, not just Israel never done it, but there's just moral things that you kind of you should not supposed to do, and you're not supposed to see as a human being, you know. So regardless of those people that think there's maybe any kind of justice, which is the second half of my answer, or not, you know, the stuff that was done are not stuff that should ever happen, period. End of discussion. I don't care if you're Christian, you're Jewish, you're Muslim. And by the way, it was also done to Muslims by the Muslims. There are many Muslims, they got slaughtered and kidnapped, which nobody's talking about, right? Because it's much more juicier to talk about Jewish and Arab conflict, right? But the truth is that there's a lot of Muslims that are recorded on video saying, I'm Muslim, in Arabic, and they still got shot and killed point blank, you know, range. So matter of fact, they were even mocked upon. They're like, prove me you're a Muslim, give me the Quran. And they gave him actually chapters out of Quran, and they still killed him. So just shows you the cruelty and the barbarism and those people, they do it even for Muslims. And they've done it in Jordan. They've done it in Egypt. They've done it in other Arab countries where they were basically disowned and they, you know, were not allowed to get into. And this is, again, history that a lot of people just don't know. So I feel there's a lot of ignorance, and this is basically what's fueling it, the ignorance. You know, people are just not really knowledgeable enough to know and understand a lot of things. And that's why, you know, you're sitting in the schools now, right, in colleges, and I can pull you like a million videos of those people chanting, and they're being asked, you know, this sentence you're chanting, do you know what river, what sea? And they look at one another like, no. And, you know, they just don't even know what they're chanting for. And this is not me like making this up or making claims. This is a fact. It's all over. Just search. So, you know, it's not like they're even supporting something. They don't even know what they're supporting in essence. So again, it's a lot of propaganda. That's the second half of my answer.
Yep. Yep. Well, we're, you know, praying for anybody who is innocent in this conflict, you know, to finally be able to see peace, the kind of peace that we should be able to see, you know, with our fellow man. And so we'll continue to pray for the peace in that region, and for the end of this conflict in God's timing. Well, I appreciate you sharing that, you know, and you know, I think you know, this is definitely a hard topic and not something that most people would think of on a wealth podcast. But let's just go right here. If humanity is killing one another, no one's going to be wealthy, and no one's going to be experiencing the joy of you know, deep relationships when all you're doing is just running around in fear for your life. And so I wish that people could experience that peace and experience the joy of prosperity that comes with that kind of peace. You know, so I wish that for those folks.
Amen. I wish that for them as well, because we didn't start October 7th, and anyone doing propaganda can say whatever they want. This is, again, separate fact from fiction, guys. We didn't start this. We didn't want the war. We don't want the war. We don't, you know, Israel doesn't want to be there, right? But it's kind of hard to make peace with somebody that just doesn't want you to exist, right? So what are you giving them? They just don't want you to exist. You know, they're standing behind kids, and shooting, using them as human shield. And we, and in Israel's basically standing in front of the kids, protecting them. This is just the basic understanding that people need to realize. You know, there's evidence of missiles inside schools, inside daycares, you know, inside hospitals. This is not Israel making this up. There's footage all over, you know. It's just not comfortable for people to talk about that. But, you know, when you're shooting missiles out of school and then say, oh, the IDF, the Israel Defense Force, is basically launching missiles at schools. Right. Well, you're kind of missing the first half, buddy. You know, and by the way, before they do so, they send drones that drop notes saying, they're giving them a notice at what time they have to evacuate. They give them a few hours to leave, right? And I don't know any army that gives notice to terrorists before they drop bombs. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. If people would only take the time, you can Google the Hamas charter, and I did that. And if you just read through it, you'll very quickly see that since the 1980s, these folks, this group has had it in for Jews, anywhere, not just Israel, Jews. And that the only answer to the Palestinian problem or conflict is to eradicate Israel and Jews.
Miss Hillary Clinton said herself on record, they were given a land when Israel left in 2005, Gaza, and that entire region. Everyone says, you know, we occupy, you know, free Palestine, all the chanting. We haven't been there since 2005. This is a fact. And Ms. Hillary Clinton on record saying they were given a golden opportunity to build a place as magnificent as Singapore with the amount of money that Qatar and everyone was giving them to aid them to build their own state. And what do? They dig tunnels and fill them with missiles to shoot, right? So I'm sorry, I just don't see how, and I want peace just like anybody. I'm telling you, I just don't know how, you know? I just don't know how.
Yep. No, I feel you, man. Yeah. Well, I'm sure all of this has, you know, impacted your life. This is all stuff that is in the background that is a component of who you are. This is really, you know, Doran Levi's experience, you know. And so it's important to understanding where you've come from and to reach what you've accomplished so far. So I would like to dive in a little bit. And how did you get started into real estate from this immigrant who came with very little English? How then did you move in to investing into real estate? What drew you into it? And what were some of those initial challenges you faced getting into that?
Wow. That's a very long answer, so I'll try to summarize it. You know, the first 5 years I did everything under the sun in order to survive, right? And that's just the reality. By the time I start getting my papers, and I wasn't a citizen then, but you know, I certainly had a bigger capacity of driving a car and having a driving license. Then I just started getting into working for myself as a self-employed, and I started basically building my own business, and that's a part of the that's the bridge to the real estate. So I'm not avoiding the question. I want to make sure you understand, and everyone else. I'm just kind of getting to the story of how I got into it. So that's the beginning. Before I got onto the bridge, that's where it started. So I've done some work for a big contractor in Philadelphia that did a lot of carpet cleaning. And what happened is 2007 rolled around. And when I used to do subcontracting for him, he came basically and he patted me on the shoulder and he said, well, nobody's cleaning their carpet now. You have yourself a good day. I'm shutting down. Best of luck. And so I just got my first house. I was, I think I was 27 or 28. Wife is pregnant any minute, is having my first baby. And I'm like scratching my head, what am I going to do? So I looked at another Israeli guy that was kind of looking back at me with two kids, 10 years older than me. Okay, now what are we going to do now? And, we're going to do whatever we know, clean carpets. That's the only thing we know. So, okay, let's open a company. Let's do it. All right, we're doing it. And, like anybody opening a business for the first time, it wasn't easy. And, I was pushing as hard as I can because that's what I know how to do ever since I remember. And I was lucky enough to kind of, be able to do some success. And every time I made three steps ahead with the business, he basically pulled the carpet under my feet and took me back. Fast forward about close to 4 years, 3.5 years, I sat him down. I told him, listen, Joe, we got into this as friends. I want to, we're in $350,000 debt. We almost went under a couple times. It's not working out. I mean, I didn't tell him he didn't carry his weight, as an owner, because if he's 1 o'clock, at 1 p.m. in the public pool with his family, and I'm working till 9 p.m. and I'm doing 90% of the work for 50% of the profits, then it's not really fair for me. I was working on getting all those relationships, and I was working on creating the systems and all those things in place. And, and I kind of knew the answer because I told him, hey, just either you buy me out or I'll buy you out. And I didn't even have a dime. He'd like to buy him out. But I knew he couldn't run it. So I basically figured the next day he came, he's like, just buy me out. And I'm like, okay, how am I going to do that? Like, I don't have money. So I did a creative move.
Yep.
And I didn't even know how I came up with this, but I basically got a line of credit against my receivables. So people owed me money, and I was able to, through a couple of brokers, find someone, a small bank that was basically wanting to loan money to me on a line of credit against my, I think it was 70% or something like that, of my receivables. So I'm like, aha. So here I am, like, giving him $200,000 that I don't even have when I'm $350,000 in debt. So I'm about $550,000 in a hole. And then he's leaving with $200,000 and I'm staying with all the debt. Yeah.
I know.
So that was fun. And then, again, do or die, right? Do or die, baby. I gotta make this work. I have to make this work. I'm new here. I'm building my credit. I can't screw this up with going filing Chapter 11. It's the last thing I want to do, like bankruptcy, Like, I really had everything to lose. And something to be said about people that just have no choices. And this is something that I want to kind of say out loud for anybody listening here. When you're sitting in comfort, then you're acting as as someone in comfort. But when your back's against the wall and it's a do or die, you're acting differently. When your neck is out and the guillotine's above your neck, it's a different environment, Long story short, fast forward, I was able to build a company and basically make it, to a point where I went from about 5 employees to about 37 employees, 6-figure company to 7-figure company. I was able to scale it through different, adding some more services and a whole bunch of jazz. And, I used the same customer base that I had because to open the other company, because we did good by people, you know, and people really liked that and appreciated that. And so they were very loyal to us. And that was my business model. And, you know, in hindsight, it was a good one. You know, back then it just felt like the right thing to do, you know. And so I was able to leverage the same database of people to the next company. And then fast forward, you know, scaling from six to seven figures, sold for seven figures. And then I lost my dad accidentally. It's not the right word. It was unexpectedly, you know, and that kind of really messed with my head. And I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. You know, I want to be more present. You know, I have two kids now. I want to be there, you know, and I don't want to build and scale companies and sell them. I don't, you know, I want to be more present. And so I sold it. I had a good amount of capital and I'm like, okay, so what can I do now with the amount of knowledge I have, you know, that I can basically make big steps. You know, I'm not young. I'm not 20. I don't have a lot of rope left, you know. And I was looking at it not as an ROI, like a return on investment as far as taking the capital and putting it somewhere. It's more like an ROE, like return on time. You know, what can I do in a short period of time that will get me the furthest? That's kind of how I looked at it. And I'm like, I'll do multifamily. Because multifamily, I can scale. And I can relatively make big moves in a short period of time. So I'm going, I'm buying a half a block of warehouse. I'm knocking it down. I'm basically subdividing it. I'm doing like, you know, land entitlement. And then I'm selling half of the land for whatever it cost me for the entire warehouse. So I brought all my money back. And then I took the money and I basically used it as a construction loan to put down as a construction loan. And I erected a 25 unit complex building. Mind you, I never did a fix and flip. I didn't do any kind of construction in my life. Heck, I couldn't set apart a 2x4 from a hole in the wall. You know, I just, yeah. But, you know, I looked at it as a business because at the end of the day, multifamily is a living, breathing business. And so in the construction phase, I looked at it as a business. I was running it lean. I had good systems in place. I was running it efficiently, you know. And because I had the backbone of what I've done in the past, I was able to relatively, you know, quickly monetize on the multifamily play. And then, you know, a couple of years later, when I'm done with this one, like it was about 2 years, a little under even. I went back and I actually bought the other half back because the guy never did anything with it. And I put another complex there. So that's kind of how I started.
Yes.
I think it was like 2017, I think. By the time I finished. You have to remember, every cycle of development is about, you know, it could take 2 to 3 years. So, but once you have the first one, you kind of have a proof of concept. Then I want to kind of say you're starting to have an appetite because you can tell yourself, okay, I can do this, you know? And, that's kind of how it looked in my mind. Yeah.
Wow. I'm curious with no construction experience, no real estate, you know, experience per se. I feel like that's a big challenge for a lot of folks. Where in order to find funding as a newbie, so to speak, diving into such a large project, how did you swing that?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, you know, Pace speaks about, you know, finding the who, not the how. You know, construction is not, and I'm sorry if I'm, I don't mean it in any bad way. It's not rocket science. You know, it's not. Like, you can learn that And I basically started researching. I started learning. I started, like anything I've done since I'm 14, which is figuring out the parts, how they connect, and the mechanism that gets them moving. I've done the same exact thing. It's like, for me, it's not new. It's just different parts in a different machine. You know, I mean, I know it's very high level, but that's just the truth. And again, I was just all in. I have a high risk tolerance, which not a lot of people have, but that certainly helped. You know, when I took all the proceeds from the last business I sold, and like a casino, I basically went all in, you know. Some people might think it's not smart. Some people might think it's even stupid, you know. But I just kept gambling, like betting on myself. And it's not to sound cocky. It's just that, you know, do or die. You know, you just got to, you do or die. It's just like that mold was in me so many years, you know, half of my life, if not more. And that's kind of what I always fell back for, because it's my DNA.
Yeah. And you still own that first property that you invested in?
Yeah. I mean, everything I build, I hold. I have a property management company. So we basically run and hold all the doors that I have. I still have it.
That's amazing, man. What would you say you put into it, and what is it worth roughly today? Taking that risk on yourself.
Yeah. I put into it about, I would say, all in about between the construction cost and the soft cost, I would say by 900,000, so close to a million. Like the acquisition was about 600 some, and then all the soft costs to develop everything. And then the first one, so it turned out to be about an appraisal that had switching to permanent, it was 7.2 million.
What was it? 17 point what?
7.2 million.
7.2 million.
Yeah. We got evaluated to go to permanent. So it had to be evaluated going from the construction to, so it was evaluated at 7.2. Now it's probably, well, most likely worth much more, right?
Yeah, that's amazing. So you basically turned 900,000 into 7.2 million.
Right, and that's only on one half.
Exactly, yeah.
I have another
half. Other half too, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice, that's amazing, man. I need to hang out with you some more. Yeah. You're working on an amazing project right now. I keep seeing the updates, and I'm like hungry for every picture that you send of it. Is it okay if I show some pictures of?
Thank you for saying that. You know, it means a lot. It's so much work. It's almost 3 years. Well, actually, it's more than 3 years. So thank you. Put a lot of work in it.
Heck yeah. Yeah. Let me see if I can pull this up here. But
yeah,
it's here we go. Boom, look at that. He even says, wow, look at that.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. Tell us about this project, man. This is an amazing resort. And I just have to remark the styling and the design of it is awesome. Like, I want to go there and swim in that pool right now.
You will. You better. You will.
But yeah, tell us about this project, man.
So this used to be a senior assisted living that, basically got kind of, you know, there's no easy way to say it, but wiped out in COVID. Most of the people that didn't survive. And then, you know, when I bought it, you know, we bought it, acquisition was about 3.2 million and, got about 4 million construction loan towards a 50 unit apartment, then building conversion. So we wanted to do a multi out of it. And, you know, about a year into it, suddenly they cut off the Airbnb. They said, you know, in Philadelphia, they said, you can't do any more Airbnb. So, you know, I started thinking about that fact, and I'm like, okay, so, you know, I'm looking around, I see all my friends are basically, everybody I know in real estate just dumping their real estate, their apartments and just running for the hills. And I'm like, where is all the short-term stay people going to go? Like, where the, you know, short and mid-term are going to go? And then I kind of recognize if it's going to be a void in the market, right? Because Philadelphia is a very, you know, touristical proper, you know, area, and a lot of people come for the hospitals between CHOP Hospital and you know, Temple University. There's a lot of traffic into the city, you know. So I'm like, let me try to pivot here and make a hotel out of this, and you know, start a very long process of variance. Eventually, was able to get a hotel license, and then got an additional $4.5 million loan on top of the $4 million I already had to do the conversion for the hotel. So I was about 8.5 plus 3.2, so I was about close to $12 million in. And I got an appraisal of $25 million pre-stabilization at 70% completion, and fully stabilized at $30 million. So I think I did okay with it. But it's a very long process because it's an historical building, and there's, you know, floor on floor on floor and wall on top of a wall, and a lot of asbestos and a lot of you know, lead-based paint, and it's a structure from the 1700s, so you have to make sure you maintain the integrity of the building from the outside. You know, it took just 6 months to approve the windows, you know, but listen, I poured all my development relationships into this. Like I have a lot of relationship from overseas. Like, I get my cabinets from Turkey. I have a lot of stone coming in from Greece for my project that I do in the multifamily. This build basically got all my vendors, like stuff from Italy. I had the pool flown in from London. The design team that I have for this hotel, they're all from Europe. We're going for a very unique model that yet to be seen in the U.S. I'm kind of, frankly, creating a footprint that if I'm able to pull this off, which, you know, cross my fingers, it's not over till it's over, although I'm a few weeks from opening, then I might actually even duplicate, potentially. But we'll see. You know, I don't like to talk, you know, too much about things before they're done. It's bad luck.
Sure.
but yeah, man, it was a lot of work. Like I said, it's over 3 years, and I'm right at the end of it.
That's amazing, man. I mean, you kind of alluded to some of the unique challenges that were involved having to pivot in this project. What were some other, you know, unique challenges about this one that you hadn't had to deal with in some of your previous work?
Well, taking the commercial space and making a conversion for an outfit of such magnitude. So if you think about it, they had a cafeteria that was basically turned into a chef restaurant. The whole kitchen had to be completely vamped up, everything brand new, nothing originally left other than the cooling room. And then you had to kind of restructure the entire commercial space on the first level and the basement level, because on the bottom of the level, you had to put, you know, filter room for the pool, and you had to put a gym, and you had to put sauna, you had to put like different spaces and areas. that you otherwise would never, you know, had to do in any kind of a build. And it was really, really challenging. Two bars, you know, there's a bar for the restaurant. There's another bar right next to the pool, because the whole courtyard was basically turned over to a pool area, you know? So there's just really a lot of complexity and a lot of moving parts that you have to figure out how you're designing them to fit together. You know, there's a certain flow, and the flow is not just a mechanical, technical one. It's also a financial model that works. You know, we had probably about over 10 chefs interviewed. It's not just, you know, the financial negotiation. It's the right person as an operator for that restaurant. They kind of would be able to live with the entire concept of what it is that's being tried, you know, try to accomplish there. And even the outside, and you've seen it, you know, opening balconies to have view for the pool so you can charge more for rooms with pool views, right? Like really maximizing and optimizing the performa in such a way that you can only do when you're building it. So you literally have a one shot at it. I mean, if you don't do this right, you're not going to start doing demolition and then, you know, redo things over again. So, so yeah, again, it was very, very intense, and it's still intense. You know, we got all the furniture basically fabricated in Indonesia, because the markup here is like, you know, 600% on furniture. So things are getting stuck at sea. You know, we were supposed to get stuff like May, early May, end of April. We still didn't get it. And next week we're getting the first delivery only for 20 rooms, you know? So there's a lot of things going on. I mean, the stone from Italy came faster than the furniture. And, you know, and there's a lot of custom glasses that needs to be done for the custom showers. You saw the picture. These showers are nothing but conventional, right? So just the glass alone on this thing, I'm not talking about just the weight, but the amount of work involved in customizing everything based on the designer's specifications. Because this is not like I'll do whatever I want. It's not. I have to follow a blueprint by the designers. The tiles on the floor, we mm-hmm. had numbers. We had pieces of paper hung on the wall with numbers. Number one was the orange, number two was the tan, number three was the black. And there was a diagram showing exactly where every color tile needs to be. And if you think mm-hmm. people didn't screw it up and need to rip it up again, think again. Because those things happen. We're human. You know, the guys working there with no air before we got their air condition. You know, people are tired. They're running Saturdays and Sundays because it's go, go, go. You know, it's a lot. It's a lot, and the structure, you know, being plaster and old build doesn't, you know, didn't really help. Also, help.
Yeah.
I mean, just to put the sprinkler system through everything here, you know, being such an old building, it was a nightmare.
Now, as a multi developer and a multifamily developer and builder, other than this one, what have been some of your most significant projects that you've worked on?
I can say, you know, a neighborhood of luxury homes. I'm not done with it yet, but you need to understand, the listeners need to understand, you know, this is not a quick in and out, you know. This is like the cycle of these things are, you know, could be a year, could be 2 years, could be 3 years, like the one you've seen. And you got to be careful not to spread yourself too thin with resources. And I don't believe in quantity. I believe in quality, and, you know, not biting more than you can swallow. You know, I certainly made mistakes earlier, you know, in my career, in different things I've touched in business, by the way, not in real estate yet, touch wood, hopefully it's going to stay that way, that, you know, taught me just that. Mm-hmm. And just to drive value to this conversation, not just another anything that shines as gold, but sometimes the best projects are the one you're not taking. You know, there's a lot of people taking stuff because they think they can really monetize on them, and it's a Pandora box. And sometimes, you know, as nice as it looks like as far as like profit goes and opportunity, sometimes, you know, the best thing you can do is walk away, you know. And that's why I say a lot of no's. You know, for every yes, I probably say, you know, 10 no's. And it's only to consider. And after I consider, I probably also say no to it, because I'm very picky where I put my time. And people, I think, are kind of missing out on that, because there's just so much abundance out there. You know, you don't really need to just take stuff, and you don't really need to. And I know you didn't ask me, but I think abundance. I think about good business practice and bad business practices. And some people are not doing the best business practices. And I'm just thinking there's no need for that. There's so much opportunities and there's so many good people out there. You know, you have the choice of just choosing differently. It's not like, you know, and this is a guy that needed to do things to survive. And I had, you know, any reason to do bad business practice just simply to survive, you know, when I started, and I still chose not to, you know. So that's just something that I feel that I want to tell you when I think about abundance and choices.
Yeah, that's good. Diving into a little bit more of the practical side of this space, what are some of the key elements that you consider when you're evaluating whether a multifamily property is going to be a good investment?
A ground up or an acquisition?
Let's go ground up.
Okay, there's a lot of market analysis that needs to be done, and I believe in doing a lot of homework before I pull the trigger on anything. Even before I draft an LOI, like some people just flood LOIs and they throw so much spaghetti on the wall and see what sticks. Sometimes I'll do that, but I wouldn't do it certainly as much as a lot of people that I know. But there's a lot of, if you're asking me for pointers, a lot of work that you want to do on the, you know, in the beginning stage that can save you so much trouble, work, and potentially even a bad deal. Like demographics, like market analysis, who else is basically competing for your customer, right? Like if you know you're looking for this type of clientele or this type of customers, who else is in the neighborhood targeting them, how much they're charging, what are the amenities they're offering, right? You know, I've done extreme things as calling the offices even, you know. And I ask people in my office to literally get on the phone with the girls in listing offices and get to, you know, what are they getting for their rent? Is utilities included? Are utilities included? So, you know, price points, just a lot of research. I believe that knowledge is power, you know, and the more research you do, the more knowledge you have, the better decisions you make.
Mm-hmm. And how about shifting into acquisition? Because I know you do that as well. What's some of the key factors there with an existing property?
Yeah. So on the acquisition side, I got basically three main things to say. When you're doing due diligence and people give you like the pro forma and the T12, you know, the T12s and the rent rolls and all that stuff. Doubt, and doubt, right? Yeah. That's the best advice I can give you. Nothing is what it appears. Don't believe anything, you know, and even if my brother or my family member is going to sell me a multi, I'll still ask a bunch of questions and I'll go back and forth and, you know, you have to validate the information being given to you, and you can get really creative. And a lot of people just ask for leases, but I don't just ask for leases and I cross-reference them with a rent roll. I also ask for bank statements. I want to see how the money travels, right? So if you're telling me that you're getting $500 a room and you got 100 units, I want to see that lump sum going into your bank account. And I want to see it constantly, not 1 month, right? And then what else I want to do, I want to look at your expenses and I want to make sure that your expenses are what you're saying they are, and they're not much greater than what you're disclosing to me. Because if your expenses are more than you're disclosing to me, what does that tell me about my profit, right? Because if I'm making, you know, $1 million a year and you're telling me the expenses are only 200, then I'm expecting to have 800 after expenses. But if they're 400, then I'm getting much less. So I always check income taxes. I check 3 years back. It sounds a little extreme, but I don't care. One thing's for sure, you know, people will want to write off their expenses with Uncle Sam. Right? So I wish somebody would tell me that, but you know, you ask me for pointers and I'm trying to drive value. So I'm kind of giving you some secrets here, you know, and I can't tell you how many times. Matter of fact, I'm doing a due diligence now that I found, hold your chair, $426,000 of expenses that were not disclosed. Yeah, true story. Where? On the income tax. Yeah. Not on the T12. Not on the pro forma. Yeah, on the income tax. True story. So, you know, this is why. Because, you know, they paint you the picture and it's never the picture. I mean, there's always something. You know, it could be small. It could be extremely big. But you want to know those things during the due diligence period. Try to keep your money soft, like your EMD. In multifamily, it's usually, you know, could be significant, could be a few hundreds of thousands of dollars, and you don't want it going hard. So make sure during the due diligence period it stays soft. In case you find those things, you can pull out safely without losing your earnest money deposit.
How can investors strategically, when they acquire a multifamily, how can they strategically add value to multifamily properties? What are some of the primary methodologies?
Yeah, there's a couple ways, right? The way I look at it is invasive and non-invasive. An invasive one would be like a rehab, a reconstruction. And there's certainly plays that are solely based on that type of a play where you're getting, you know, a multi that is half occupied or very low occupancy, and then you basically renovate the units that are empty, and then you move tenants over, and then you renovate the other one. But that's costly, and that's resource intense. Like it takes time, takes money, takes manpower, right? Because if you're renovating, I don't know, 70, 80 rooms, you can't do it with two people, right? So that's the invasive way of doing a value add. And you can certainly do, you know, make good deals by getting something cheaper with that play in mind. But the caveat is you really got to know what you're doing. You got to, you know, make sure the numbers are, you got the numbers right. And that you can make commitments based on that to your investors if you got investors, because if not, you know, it's one thing to get in trouble with your money, but it's something completely different with someone else's, you know, especially for me. Like I'll sell the shirt off my back if someone put a dime in my deal. Like I take, like all the problems I've seen in so many things I've done in my life, nothing made me lose sleep than choppy water when I had someone else's money in my deals. Like for me, like I'll lose my own money and I don't want to say I'm going to be okay with it, because I'm not going to be okay with it, but it's not going to, you know, it's not going to shake me as much as potentially being able to lose someone else's money. So, you know, you got to really think about that as well when you're going into really complex situations and being mindful of it. And the non-invasive way of doing a value add is basically identifying either a pain point that you can get it cheaper and increase the cushion. Like, for example, something I'm doing now, I have about a $4 million cushion between the appraisal value and what I got it. So I have a big gap. But more so with the value add is if you can identify below rent market values that you can increase, like I've done plays that I could have increased 20%, rents to market value, then you're automatically improving your appraised value as well because it derives off of the income. So this is the non-invasive and by far is the better scenario than the invasive one in my humble opinion. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the least amount of work for the biggest, potential gain.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, anybody can work hard. I mean, we want to try to work smart, right?
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. What are some of the, biggest pitfalls that you think people fall into with multifamily? We obviously have, I've heard it said that there's a bloodbath, that's coming with multifamily. And a lot of it is due to, bridge loans being called due and maybe just, kind of not forward thinking, it seems like, from a lot of investors, and just kind of recognizing the economic climate that we're in. But I'd love to hear your assessment of that. What are some of the biggest, failures that people make in regard to multifamily?
Yeah. So again, I said it before, you have to look at it as a business, not as real estate. And a lot of people are looking at it as real estate. There's no wishful thinking here. You have to know the numbers and you have to be precise with it. And you got to hedge your risk, meaning, it's not like fluffy slogans like, hope for the best, prepare for the worst. You need to underwrite it accordingly. So, if you're underwriting it instead of, 70%, or 75% the conventional lender would do, is 75% LTV, at 60%, then you're allowing yourself a shoulder to hedge your risk. I don't like to lend 75% LTV. I like to have bigger cushion for market shifts. And then I don't find myself in trouble. And another thing you mentioned is, another thing you said, but another thing you reminded me, not that you said, is another thing that people have now trouble with is the syndications, right? Like, because when you're syndicating, you're promising someone a certain return on his money. And now with the interest going up, then you're not able to deliver what you promised. Now, of course, you can come and say, it's not my fault. I can't control the interest rate, which is true. But if you hedged things with wide enough shoulders, you could have certainly done a better job. Absolutely. I'm telling you that from experience. I'm not perfect, don't get me wrong. I'm not pretending to be, but it's all about the underwriting. It's all about understanding the numbers, and it's all about hedging the risk. And the reason that banks will always come up top, obviously there's always going to be extreme cases, but most of the time, is because their focus is just risk management. That's it. They're not smarter than me and you. They're just focused on risk assessment. As a matter of fact, not only did they're not as smart as me and you, I had bankers, including a very high ranked banker one time in one of my projects. They know nothing about construction. Absolutely nothing. But they know how to do a risk assessment. They know that very well. And that's the one thing that, people need to understand. It's more important than how nice your building looks or cash flow, your risk assessment.
I know that you happen to be currently raising capital for a 120-unit property in Myrtle Beach. Can you tell us a little bit more about this deal and what you're offering to your capital partners?
Yeah, so shameless plug, but I didn't initiate it, so...
I initiated it.
Okay. Well, thank you, I guess. I'm just joking, obviously. So the specs on this deal is that it was originally offered for a little under $14 million. It was, I think, $13.8 million. It's located in Myrtle Beach, which is a great area as far as, you know, job growth, as far as population growth. There's a lot of traffic, of good things going on. I also look at, like, just generally speaking, home values in the area. I'm looking at, you know, how much they increased in the past few years, and I'm looking to see by how long it takes for them to actually sell, like days on market, to kind of understand a little bit of statistics about the area. And it's a very nice area. I think I don't have the IRR numbers and things like that. It's not in front of me. It caught me off guard. But I can tell you that I was negotiating it down to 12.65, although there's an appraisal in hand at $15.5 million. So I'm coming in at a very high spread, which is something I always like to do. Like I said, increase the shoulders of safety, right? I said it. This is it. This is literally it. You know, you're not buying it at a 75% LTV. You know, you're buying it you're buying it at a much better price. And that's the first thing, the shoulders, that is very attractive with it. The second thing is that there's also a value add play, because it's 20% below, close to 20% below market value as far as the rents go. And that is a really, really neat thing, because what I did, I basically made sure that, because it's springtime now, that the turnover will be at market value. So as I'm doing my due diligence and tenants are actually turning over, they're coming in at market value. So what I put on my agreement of sale, that renewals must be at market value, because I don't want him just to put people, you know, below market value, because I want him at a higher point. And what happens now, it's already worth more than $16 million. It's very close. It's either 16.1 or $16 million, because the rents are already increasing. So this is the efficiency that I was talking about in my bills, that I'm thinking of how doing as much as possible in a short period of time. So versus, you know, just taking whatever it is, and then once I have it, I start doing it. I'm already doing it, and it's not even mine. You know what I mean? Like, I'm already increasing the value. So it's a great property. You know, it's an exciting opportunity, and within I think 4 years or so, 4 years is going to be over $20 million, and by year five, it's going to be close to $23 million on the evaluations. So, you know, a lot of risk shoulder right there, you know, like I said, it's all about the underwriting and make those shoulders. Even if there's any volatility in the market, you're still going to be good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so you're raising capital for that. I'm assuming that it is primarily for the entry fee, to be able to get into this deal. What is the capital raise going to be for? What's it going to cover? And then for those who are bringing capital, private capital, what's the offering there?
Yeah. So I don't have the OM in front of me. If you have it, then you can give the offer exactly. But I mean, as far as the IRR and things like that, but, I'm raising basically, I think it's a $3.5 million or $3.85 million, and then the rest I'm doing just a conventional. So the offering is 60%, and it's a relatively short. It's not a five. It's not a conventional 5 year land. It's actually a 30 month, which is a 2.5 years, because 24 months is 2 years, and 6 more months is 2.5 years. So in two and a half years, yeah, 3.85. In 2.5 years, you basically getting your money back, but up to that point, you're actually getting 60% of the cash flow and the equity. And then when you get your capital back, it kind of flops into a 40-60. So you're getting, quote unquote, only 40, but the piece that needs to be spoken about is the fact that you don't have any money in the deal. So in essence, you're making infinite return because you don't have a dime in the deal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's just a super sexy offer. And I believe in creating partnerships that are really, really beneficial. In other words, I look for people not to put money only once. I look for people to put money in a lot of other deals. So I'm actually giving them a piece of the pie, which a lot of people don't do. Mm-hmm. They just give money for the duration the money's in there. And then they tell them, oh, your ROI is great, your RRR is great, you know, cash on cash, income multiples and all that jazz, which is great. But it's up to the time they get their money out, then they're done. And I'm saying, no, if you're kind enough to believe in me and put money in my deal, then I'm making you my partner. And even if after I give you the money, you know, whenever this thing's worth $23 million, you have still 40% of the upside of the equity. And
dang.
40% every single month of the net income that thing produces.
Yeah, amazing.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's an amazing deal. So if you are listening and you have deep pockets and you're ready to go and dive into a great deal, hit me up. I'll get you in contact with this guy. All right. Well, that's an awesome deal. I do want to dive in. We're getting tight on time, but I want to hit on this topic of core beliefs, because it's so essential. You know, Pace and I had a great podcast about it, talking about the three things that every person needs in as an investor. And we definitely got deep into this topic of what are your core beliefs and your practices that are so essential to your business. So, you know, what are your core beliefs? What are your practices? What do you attribute to your success in business and real estate in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really simple answer, you know. This is it in a nutshell, right? Like, I had probably hundreds of people working for me. And the reason I'm bringing this up in relationship to your question is because we always train people to do their job right. But we also train them to do the right thing. And there are two different things. So you can learn how to do things right, but a lot of people wouldn't tell you how to do the right thing. So it's more than just, you know, knowing how to do things. It's also always to do right by people. And I think that's the key component for my success. Because as smart and sharp as you want to give me credit that I am, I would not be able to succeed if I would have a bad reputation. I would not be able to scale my businesses and my multifamily and everything I've done thus far as quick, as efficient, and as nice as I was able to if I would not do right by people. And that's the first and foremost important thing that I want to kind of point out. I practice and believe in the Bible just like yourself, and I think I got a lot of wisdom on how to, you know, operate from the Bible. You know, don't do anything to somebody else that you wouldn't want them to do to you. And now it sounds really tacky, but it's just the truth. I raise my kids with the same exact way. And you know, you got to really be mindful on how you operate in the world with people and hold yourself to the standard of how you act. That's really important. Integrity is really in the center. And I think that any common people that we know will tell you that that's a very strong virtue of me. Like, I will not, I will not BS you. If I don't know the answer, I'm not going to fake it like I do. I will tell you I don't know, but I'll find out, you know? And if I know and you wouldn't like the answer, I'll still give it to you because A, it's the right thing to do, and B, you're probably going to appreciate me more for at least being honest with you. And if I can't monetize on you, that's okay. But if I go around and say, hey, listen, this guy could have taken advantage of me, chose not to. And guess what? Other people hearing that, they will want to do business with me. Right? So people need to understand that how you act in the world, in the space you're at, will come back to you. It's you know, some people call it karma. Some people call it the other thing. But this is the reason. I just gave it to you. And, you know, and that's why I was able to get a lot of good opportunities, because people knew who I am and people wanted to invest with me and people wanted to do business with me. And people trusted me because of how I act. You know, it all kind of ties into, you know, it together to the same big picture I'm trying to tell you since the beginning of the conversation.
Yeah. Looking ahead, what are your goals? What are your aspirations for the future in your business endeavors?
First and foremost, I want to make sure that I put value and just good business practice out there. I know I'm being redundant, but I hope that I will find the right people to join me in that mind frame to my missions. And I'm bringing this up because a lot of times it's not an easy task. You know, people thinking about how can I get the capital? How can I get the opportunity? You know, but a lot of times it's very hard to also find the people to execute on things the way you want to do it. And any small business owner knows that, you know, the hardest thing in a business is finding the right people, right? And I've been fortunate enough to be able to know how to find them because I have some experience under my belt. But the truth of the matter that as you grow and you evolve and you're asking me with a view to the future, a lot of people that got you here wouldn't necessarily get you there. So, you know, once I have that down, I'm pretty confident that nothing is going to be in our way, you know?
Love it. Doran, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you. I appreciate you sharing your story and your experiences with us.
Yeah, I'm grateful that you had me here. I really enjoyed our conversation. I always enjoy interacting with you. You share a lot of the values and the beliefs that I have, and you're very much a mind-like person like myself. So thank you for being human.
Awesome. Looking forward to whatever future we have here together. To our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in. If you enjoyed this episode, please like and subscribe to our YouTube channel. We'd love to hear your feedback in the comments below. Join us every other Tuesday for more insightful discussions on Nursing Real Wealth. Have a great day and God bless.